If you would please open your Bibles to Joshua chapter 11. Joshua chapter 11. Axis and Allies. During World War II, the world began to divide itself up. You had two primary coalitions, alliances, fighting against one another. One known as the Axis powers included many different nations, but was primarily led by Germany, Italy, and Japan. You had the Allied powers, as we refer to it. Again, many countries were involved, and with both of these coalitions, countries would come and go during the course of the war. But the Allied forces were primarily led by three powers: the United Kingdom, also the United States, and the Soviet Union. The world had to decide where they would stand. Nations had to decide which alliance, which coalition they would join. And that decision could be a matter of life and death. How would they make that decision? Would it be made on principles of right and wrong? Would it be made merely on power, who had the most power? Would it be basically made just to see what decision would allow us to survive? Would it be a combination of those things? I just want you to see that the world was going through a process of deciding where they would put their allegiance, where they would create alliances. And those choices were, in a very real way, matters of life and death. Tonight I want us to look at the alliance. The Northern Alliance, found in Joshua chapter 11 and Joshua chapter 12. As we look at this alliance, we are seeing people making choices all across the land of Canaan. The people of Jericho made a choice. Rahab made a choice. The people of Ai made a choice. The people of Gibeon made a choice. The people of the south made a choice. Now the kingdoms of the north, they're making a choice. Who will they ally with? Will they seek peace? Will they go to war? Will they hide behind their walls? Will they take the battle to their enemy? And these decisions are matters of life and death. What we've been looking at over the last few weeks, maybe you can see laid out on this map, is we've been looking at the conquest of the promised land. God made a promise to Abraham back in Genesis chapter 12. The key to that promise was that through him all nations of the earth would be blessed. But secondary to that great promise were two other promises: that his people would become a great nation and that they would be given a land of their own. Now, hundreds of years later, that is in the process of becoming a reality. What we focused on is how they journeyed across the Jordan River, and remember, they cut a wedge right down the middle of the promised land. This morning we talked about the battle that took place in the south as the southern kings, five kingdoms in particular, joined together and attacked Gibeon because Gibeon had made an alliance with Israel. Israel came to Gibeon's defense and destroyed those southern kingdoms that had risen up against them and the other cities that were around them. And we talked about that this morning. What I'd like to do tonight is to look at a northern alliance. We're going to see, as you look at this map, there's a red arrow that goes up north. We're going to look at what happened next as they went up to the northern end of the land of Canaan. And as the young folks get ready for Lads to Leaders next week, I really wanted to at least get to this point before they went. Because at this point, when we finish tonight's lesson, for all practical purposes, though it's not complete, and we will talk about that in the future, but for all practical purposes, the children of Israel, after tonight, will have control of the land of Canaan. So let's talk about that final stage in this initial series of campaigns to take the land of Canaan. Now, as we think about some points to ponder tonight, I'm going to use the letter H as our memory glue. I want to talk about a hard battle, hardened hearts, and healthy leadership. A hard battle, hardened hearts, and healthy leadership. But let's begin with the text. Let's look in Joshua chapter 11, beginning in verse 1. Then it came about that Jabin, king of Hazor, heard of it, that he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Akshaph, and to the kings who were of the north in the hill country, and in the Arabah, south of Chinnereth, and in the lowland, and in the heights of Dor on the west, to the Canaanite on the east and on the west, and the Amorite, and the Hittite, and the Perizzite, and the Jebusite in the hill country, and the Hivite at the foot of Hermon in the land of Mizpah. Now remember, we talked about those five kingdoms this morning that formed the southern alliance. Now we're seeing a coalition of four cities that are going to be at the heart of the northern alliance. Now they are by no means the only cities. But as you can look on this particular list on the screen, here's the heart of the alliance. You have Hazor, which is the main city in this area. All the other cities and small villages in this region seem to have functioned as vassal kingdoms to Hazor. And remember we talked about this morning, we're talking about a vassal. It's basically a kingdom that serves another kingdom. There would be times when surrounding nations were vassal nations to Israel. In other words, Israel was the power and all the others served them and likewise received protection from them. There were also times when Israel functioned as a vassal kingdom of maybe Assyria or Egypt or Babylon. In other words, it depended on which city or kingdom was the strongest that determined who was the top dog. And then basically most of the nations around them made some kind of peace treaty that said, you're the boss, you're in charge, don't kill us and protect us if somebody comes after us. That's basically what the people of Gibeon did in their relationship with Israel. And so that's basically probably what most of the nations or cities around Hazor had done. And so they're kind of the top dog in the area. And so as you notice, the text is going to begin by saying, and when the king heard, that's a common refrain through this, and what he does is he gathers together his major allies. And so as you can see on the king, you've got Madon and Shimron and Akshaph. And then it lists then a summary of just all the different areas that he went gathering up an army. And all the different nations that are involved. Remember this morning in that battle we talked about that's going on down south? It was mostly Amorites. Okay, the people of Gibeon were Hivites. And they had made an alliance with Israel, and they were attacked by the Amorites. But this alliance is different. You can look at the list. What have you got? You got Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Jebusites, Hivites. You've got all of these different peoples from all of these different city-states who are coming together. And I want you to recognize, even though that most of these were probably in a loose alliance, my guess is, if it's like most places and most peoples where you've got people together who are different, maybe sometimes there are strange relations between them. But I want you to see now, everybody's under the same threat. And so all these different peoples, all these different cities, kingdoms, and nationalities are coming together to fight because they have one common foe. Now let's kind of get a little picture of what's going on. Before we do that, I want you to look in Joshua chapter 11, beginning in verse 4. They came out, they and all their armies with them, as many people as the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. So all these kings, having agreed, met and came together and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. I want you to recognize that something changes with each of these battles. Because you might be saying, okay, every time he preaches, somebody else is fighting somebody else. And it's just the same old story. Well, you may have the same ending, but the process of getting to that ending is different for each one. Now, again, I want you to think about what's happening. When they went to Jericho, what did Jericho do? They hid behind their walls. They went to Ai. What did Ai do? They went outside their walls, and for a little while they won. So a lot of other nations got confidence. They went to Gibeon. What did Gibeon do? They didn't try to fight at all. They used treachery to get a peace treaty with Israel. Then what happened next? Five kings come together in an alliance. But did they directly attack Israel? No, they didn't attack Israel. They attacked Gibeon, this new vassal kingdom, if you will, of Israel. In other words, Gibeon has just made a peace treaty with Israel, so they attack Gibeon. They're trying to send a message. You don't make peace with Israel. You either stand with us or with Israel. You can't have your cake and eat it too. So they attack Gibeon, then Israel comes to Gibeon's aid, and they defeat them. Well, now it's changed again. This time, what are they doing? You've got a larger coalition, and this time they're going to go directly into battle against Israel. They're not attacking a Gibeon, a city that's just made peace with them. They're going directly against Israel. And also this time they have the tanks, at least their century version of it. They have horses and chariots. This is a massive army. Some have said there might have been 300,000 soldiers. But a massive army. And when, not only do they have a huge army, but to have chariots was a major advantage on the battlefield. Not just for the movement, but they could fire from those chariots. They could throw spears, shoot arrows, etc. Many times those chariots were equipped with cutting instruments and so forth that would allow them to do damage even as they passed through the battlefield. I just want to understand, it was a significant advantage in battle. So I want you to see the stakes keep going up and up and up with every battle. And it seems almost like the local people kind of learned from the previous battle. Okay, Jericho, they didn't go out to fight, so let's go out to fight. And that's what Ai says. Okay, then we get a coalition together and we're going to go fight everybody that makes peace with them. That didn't work. Okay, well, we're going to go fight them. But this time, we're going to take more soldiers and we have weaponry they don't have. We have the tanks. In other words, we have the chariots. So potentially, this could be the most difficult battle that Israel has had to fight to this moment. It's kind of like they're throwing all their chips on the table. They're throwing everything in at once. They're throwing everything they've got left in the land of Canaan all together at one time at Israel. Now, as you look at a map here, I want to kind of get a picture of where this is all taking place. Now, as you look at our map laying out the battlefield, tonight we looked at the part down at the bottom. Do you see where you've got the red arrow that kind of cuts, you know, to the left? Remember, as you're looking at this map, north is up, south is down, east to the right, and west to the left. Over to the left on the west, you've got the Mediterranean Sea. So that kind of keep your bearings. Remember, it's always going to be the west when you're looking at a map of Israel. So they cut across the middle of the country, and then they go south and fight, and that's what we talked about this morning. But tonight, they're going north, and they're going up into the region of the Sea of Chinnereth, or we would come to know it in the New Testament as the Sea of Galilee. So in this next map, you just kind of see a layout of the area around the Sea of Galilee. And then you can see here with these four yellow boxes, some possible locations of the four primary cities that are at the heart of this particular battle. I made Hatzor's just a little bit bigger because it's Boss Hog. It's the big dog in the fight. It's the one that's leading these others. Now, many other cities and towns and peoples are involved in the fight. But these are the four primary players. And so I just want us to see that this battle is going to take place not terribly far from where Jesus would later grow up, in the region not terribly far from the Sea of Galilee. So I just want to realize they've got a hard battle ahead of them. But then what happens? If you look in Joshua chapter 11 and verse 6, and then the Lord said to Joshua, "Do not be afraid because of them, for tomorrow at this time I will deliver all of them slain before Israel. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire." And I want you to think about, you're the children of Israel, and you hear or see that this massive army is arrayed against you. It may have felt like the whole world has come together to fight you. You see chariots and horses and weaponry as far as the eye can see. Maybe as Joshua surveys this or his spies come back with reports, maybe there was a moment when he thought, we may have stepped into more than we've ever faced before. Can we do this? Can we win? I don't know. I don't know if he ever had a doubt. I don't know if he ever had a shrug about it. But I do know that God wanted to make sure he didn't. And God said, don't be afraid of them. Because tomorrow, you are going to be in complete control. Today, they look like they have the army that will win. They have the numbers, or they have the chariots. But tomorrow is going to be my day. And so Joshua and all the people of war with him came upon them suddenly by the waters of Merom and attacked them. And the Lord delivered them into the hand of Israel so that they defeated them, and they pursued them as far as Great Sidon. Would you look at what he says down in verse 9? Joshua did to them as the Lord had told him. He hamstrung their horses and burned their chariots with fire. They were a massive army. They had incredible weaponry, but the result was the same. It was the same as it had been for Jericho and Ai, for the Alliance of the South, for all the cities that had stood against them. And it's fascinating, when you get over into chapter 12, he then kind of summarizes all the kings who've been taken by the Israelites. He begins the chapter by talking about Sihon and Og, who had been taken on the eastern side of the Jordan River by Moses. So he says, here's what Moses did. This is really when it started. Because remember, those two Amorite kings were defeated by Moses and the people before they crossed over. And then that land was given to 2.5 tribes. In other words, some of the children of Israel already had their inheritance before the group ever crossed over the Jordan River to start fighting on the western side. So he goes back and reminds them of those battles. And then in chapter 12, he makes a list of 31 kings. And he lists king after king after king. King of Jericho and Ai and Hazor and Lachish and Jerusalem. On and on and on he goes down through the list. The point is that it didn't matter how strong and how powerful their armies were. God gave them the victory. I want you to notice something maybe you didn't see there that I found of particular interest. Would you look in verse 21? If you look in Joshua chapter 11, verse 21, then Joshua came at that time and cut off the Anakim from the hill country, from Hebron, from Debir, from Anab, and from the hill country of Judah, and from all the hill country of Israel. Joshua utterly destroyed them in their cities. There were no Anakim left in the land of the sons of Israel, only in Gaza, in Gath, and in Ashdod some remained. And those cities he just mentioned there at the end, that's in the region of the Philistines, that's over in southwest Israel, over close to the Mediterranean Sea. I want to share with you why that is of significance. If you've got your Bibles, I want you to go back to Deuteronomy chapter 1. Do you remember that some 40 years before, 12 spies had been sent out? Now remember, Joshua, the one who's leading this whole campaign, was one of the 12 spies. When the spies came back, remember, two of the spies, Caleb and Joshua, said, "We can do this. With God's help, we can take this land. It's incredible. Let's get it." But the 10 spies said, "No, we can't do it." And in Deuteronomy chapter 1, Moses is summarizing all of that. And I want you to notice what he says. In verse 26, summarizing how they reacted to the report of the spies, he says in verse 26 of Deuteronomy 1, "Yet you were not willing to go up, but rebelled against the command of the Lord your God. And you grumbled in your tents and said, 'Because the Lord hates us, He has brought us out of the land of Egypt to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites to destroy us. Where can we go up? Our brethren have made our hearts melt, saying, "The people are bigger and taller than we. The cities are large and fortified to heaven. And besides, we saw the sons of Anakim there." Do you see what's going on in Joshua? 40 years before, they said, "Have you seen the Anakim? Have you seen these people? There is absolutely no way we can defeat these people." And based on that report and fear of these people, they rejected the confidence of Caleb and Joshua and listened to the doubt of the ten. Spent 40 years wandering in the wilderness and died there. Now their children are going into the promised land. And I do not think it is a minor thing that right in the middle of this discussion of the battle and his success, that he stops for a moment and says, "Oh, by the way, we wiped out the Anakim. You remember the ones your moms and dads were so scared of? God utterly wiped them out before us. The only remnants that are left are living over there among the Philistines. They're not with us anymore." You see, their parents could have had the same thing. But they just wouldn't trust the power of God. You can't help but think, oh, what might have been. And now for hardened hearts. I find something that there are certain things, and sometimes it's different things that jump out to me as I'm reading through a text. And I want to share with you something that jumped out to me that I found of interest. If you look over in Joshua chapter 11 and verse 19, he's summarizing the conquest of the land. It says, "There was not a city which made peace with the sons of Israel except the Hivites living in Gibeon. They took them all in battle. For it was the Lord who hardened their hearts to meet Israel in battle in order that He might utterly destroy them." Did you hear what it said? God hardened the hearts of these kings so that they would be destroyed. I'm reminded of what Paul says over in the book of Romans. In Romans chapter 9, beginning in verse 17, it says, "For the Scripture says to Pharaoh, 'For this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you, and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth.' So then he has mercy on whom he desires, and he hardens who he desires." Now my belief is that God does not take a person trying to do good and make them evil. And I do not believe that God takes a person who's doing evil and force them against their will to do good. But I do believe that there are people who have chosen a path against God who can go so far that God will no longer let them come back. That they can go so far that repentance is no longer an option. That they can go so far that God uses them as instruments to display His power. That is what happened to Pharaoh. He got to a point of no return. There was still breath in his lungs, but God was going to harden his heart and keep him from coming back because he was going to be an instrument to show God's power. And I believe that's what happened to the land of Canaan. We need to remember that what's going on here is God is not just fulfilling a promise, but God is carrying out punishment. God has waited for hundreds of years for this moment in time. These people have been given time and opportunity to change, and they've refused to do so. And so when their sin had fulfilled its height, God brought justice on them. God is not only giving the land of Israel to them, He is taking it away from people who use the land to serve false gods. And these people had become so wicked and so evil that God, in my opinion, would no longer let them come back. And He hardened their hearts that they might be judged, and He hardened their hearts that His power might be displayed. But then, healthy leadership. I thought this was an opportune time to take a moment and look back on the leadership of Joshua. Because the heart of the military campaigning is coming to an end here. We're going to have some other things that we need to talk about and some other areas that need to be taken. But for the most part, after this battle, the land of Israel is in the hands of the Israelites. They control the major passes, the strategic high points. the major players among the enemies are defeated. The major cities are either destroyed or are now in Israelite control. So how did they get here? I just want to put up here, I want you to notice some things on the screen that I think are significant about the leadership of Joshua. And I mention this because I think it's significant for all of us, because I think most of us at some point in our lives find ourselves in positions of leadership, whether it's as a parent, whether it's as a teacher or in a workplace. And as we think about as a congregation that we're in the process, and if you're visiting, you may not have known this, we're in the process of appointing additional elders to work with the elders we have. Well, I can't think of a better place to go to learn about leadership than from a man like Joshua. As I look at what made Joshua a success, the first thing I notice is he had a sense of vision. He had a sense of what the grand mission was, the big picture. And he didn't let the small things, though he paid attention to the small details, he didn't let them become the big picture. Let me give you an example. Do you remember in our lesson this morning, we talked about the fact that these five southern kings, starting with the king of Jerusalem, had banded together, attacked Gibeon, and now were in a battle with Israel. Israel is winning the battle. They run for their lives. And remember, those five kings hide in a cave. I mean, he's got the kings trapped in a cave. But what does he do? Well, he realizes it's not enough to have the kings. He's got to get the army. He's got to defeat not only the kings, but their army. So what does he do? He doesn't say, okay, call off the battle. I need all the commanders and soldiers to gather at the cave. We've captured the kings. No. He says, listen, guys, we've got other things we need to do right now. All I want you to do is wall off the cave. Close it up, post a guard, and you keep chasing the enemy. Then when that's done and the enemy has gotten to their places of refuge and everybody comes back to camp, then he takes care of what's going on in the cave. Do you see a sense of the big picture? He could have become consumed with the cave, not have chased down the enemy, and the battle could have ended up lasting longer. And I think many times we make it more difficult for ourselves and our families and the Lord's work because we're worrying all the time about what's in the cave and not spending enough time dealing with the enemy that's out in the middle of the battlefield. Does that make sense? Not that the cave stuff doesn't need to happen, but it seems to me that Joshua had a clear sense of priorities and what was most important, and he kept that ever before him. I also find that he had a master plan. That this is not haphazard. There is strategy to what he's doing. And it is not insignificant that the first thing he does is to go right down the middle of the country and cut the place in half. Cut off communications between the north and the south before he does anything else. I also find it of interest that he not only had a vision and a plan of attack, but that he acted quickly. I hope you noticed that in what we talked about this morning about the battle in the south and tonight and the battle in the north. But as soon as he was told there was a battle at hand, and especially as soon as God told him what to do and that he had the victory, do you notice what he did in each instance? He said, well, let's get everybody rested up so they're really in good shape and energetic and have a lot of power as we go into battle. No. Do you remember what he did this morning? They marched all night long to take the enemy by surprise. And that's what he did here. Just as soon as God said, the victory is going to be yours tomorrow, it says they came suddenly upon this coalition at the waters of Merom. He didn't sit around and wait for a more opportune season. He had a vision, he had a plan of attack, and he went to work. Many times the devil wins, not because we're not willing, but because we wait. I also find it of interest that he went to great lengths to encourage his soldiers. Do you remember this morning what he did when he went back to the cave? You remember he brought out the five kings who had tried to destroy Israel. He made them lie down. And then what did he have his commanders do? Now to us it sounds cruel. Now I want you to remember, had they won, they would have done the same thing to them and then some. But I want you to realize what he's doing. God has told him to execute these kings, but why did he have his commanders place their foot symbolically on the neck of these kings? He said, because God, now he's giving the honor to God, he says, because God is going to do that to all of your enemies. People need encouragement. I know when I go to preaching camps or if I'm in Panama talking to preachers, one of the things I tell them over and over that I believe that one of our responsibilities as preachers is to be a cheerleader for the congregation. People need encouragement. I don't know about you, I do. You know, yesterday I ran in the race, really slow, but I ran and I finished. But you know, it wasn't the same for me this year as last year. You know why? Because last year, when I came down that last stretch, I had three little girls saying, "Go, Daddy." Well, I had one sick yesterday, so they couldn't be there. So when I came down that last stretch, it's just me saying, "Don't die, don't die. There's the finish line." Encouragement makes all the difference, doesn't it? Well, that's what Joshua understood. And remember at the beginning of the book, you remember what God did three times in the first chapter when Joshua just took over leadership? He said, "Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous. Be strong and courageous." You know what you find Joshua doing in Joshua chapter 10 and 11? He goes to his soldiers and said, "Be strong and courageous because God has given us the victory." People need encouragement. Joshua was also willing to admit his mistakes and overcome his mistakes. Joshua made his mistakes. 36 men died at Ai because Joshua didn't ask for the Lord's input. A battle was fought at Gibeon because Joshua didn't ask for the Lord's input. But Joshua acknowledged those mistakes, did whatever God told him to do to make those things right, and then he went on. And sometimes we mess up in one or both of those areas. First of all, we won't admit we mess up. We want to try to hide it and keep on our facade and our mask that we wear all the time. And everybody thinks that we're some kind of perfect person. I've never met one, but we want everybody to think that. They don't think it. We just naively think they do. Or, if we admit our mistake, we let it stop us and destroy us. We let the devil win. We say, "Look at what I've done. I can tell you the times I've had people in Bible studies say, 'With all I've done, how could God forgive me?' In fact, I've many times had folks say, you know, 'I'll become a Christian, but I need to be living a little better first. If you'll give me time to get my life all straightened out, then once I've got it straightened out, then I'll feel like I can come to the Lord.'" And we miss the point. We come to the Lord because we don't have it figured out. And He's our only hope of getting it straightened out. Joshua didn't let his defeats defeat him. He admitted his mistakes. He went back to the Lord, got guidance from the Lord, and he went on to the next battle. And I think that teaches us how to live and how to lead. But most importantly, he trusted God, and he did what God said to do. The theme verse for this whole section is in chapter 11 and verse 15. It says, "Just as the Lord had commanded Moses, his servant, so Moses commanded Joshua," and listen to what it says, "and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord commanded Moses." Wouldn't it be nice if say that about us? You know, what if it said, just as God through the Bible had told John Vaughn, and just as John Vaughn for 36 years has said to the Graymere Church of Christ, so it was that Graymere left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded. Could I put my name in that? Could I put my family's name in that? If they were writing about my life, could they say that Kirk did according to all that the Lord commanded? Would you take out your songbooks and turn to the hymn of encouragement? If you're turning there, President Obama has been traveling around the world, especially in Europe. And a lot of the reason he's done this is to build a coalition. You know, when the first war in Iraq took place and in the second war in Iraq, President Bush Senior and Junior, they had to build a coalition to go into those battles. And so now as the president is trying to create a surge, if you will, in Afghanistan, part of his trip is designed to create a coalition. He's trying to talk some of these nations into sending soldiers and money to help in the fight in Afghanistan. He's trying to make his case and get them on board. I would say that as you look at the coalition that was created in Joshua 11 and 12, I want us to realize that God is creating a coalition. He is looking for people who will join with Him and fight against the forces of evil in the world. The Northern Alliance, a massive army, they came together with the power of their chariots to overthrow God's will and work, and God stamped them out. God destroyed them. God burned their chariots and took apart their armies and broke their swords. Israel won because they were also in an alliance. They were also in a coalition. But they were in alliance with the God of heaven. And if you're in an alliance with the God of heaven, it doesn't matter who else is in the alliance. You will win. Because His sword will always be the sword held up in victory at the end of the battle. So my question as we get ready to sing this invitation song is, who am I in an alliance with? I can tell who I am in an alliance with by how I live, how I spend my money, how I use my tongue, how I treat my neighbor. If you're not a child of God, if you've never expressed your faith in repentance, confession, and baptism, then you are not a part of God's coalition, and you cannot win. For those of us who are Christians, have we been faithful to the God who has been faithful to us? Have we been trying to do things too long by our own power and our own might? Let's live a new way with a new trust and a new obedience, a revolutionary trust in God like never seen before. If we'll live that way, then God will work through us to do amazing things in the world. And who knows? Just as tonight we're talking about the amazing things Israel did, maybe 100 years from now, somebody will be standing before a group of people and say, "Let me tell you about those folks at Graymere. They trusted and they obeyed, and God brought about great victories through them." Won't you come if we can help you in your walk with God as we stand and sing?